I get my pen to write here, I make myself a note. There we go. In just a moment, we're going to ask Brother Thomas to lead us in prayer. Get our minds focused on spiritual things. Before that, if you'll turn to Exodus chapter 15, we're going to begin there this morning. We may have some visitors with us. Want to thank you for your presence, concern over spiritual things, and taking time to be with us this morning. We're engaged in a study of Exodus. We've got one quarter to cover 39 chapters, and we're covering about two chapters a week. And recalling the wonderful stories of Moses the Redeemer and his deliverance of the children of Israel and the forming of a nation and the beginning of the fulfillment of promises that were made to Abraham. And we're going to cover the Song of Moses in 15 and 16 and maybe get into 17. I don't know how much we'll cover this morning, but you'll be turned there. We'll ask Brother Thomas to lead us in prayer. Amen. The last week or so, we've been covering the actual departure of the Israelites from Egypt. We saw them leave Egypt in just a massive throng of humanity and cattle and sheep, and kind of meander, if you will. That's my word, meander through Goshen and in their departure from Egypt right here. And we don't know exactly the path they took. But it says at one point that God told them to turn around, and we think they probably crossed right in there. This meandering gave Pharaoh the idea that they were lost. These stupid slaves are lost, and they hadn't even got out of the country yet, and so he pursues them. They make it to the edge of the Red Sea. The people begin to murmur already. We're going to see that a number of times, even this morning, against Moses. And the Lord tells them to fear not, stand still, see the salvation of the Lord, and hold your peace while I fight for you. As Moses tells them to go forward, and it's across the Red Sea, and they're absolutely in a catch-22 between a Red Sea and a hard place or something. They're stuck. And says the destroyer went from before them, the angel of the Lord, he's called the destroyer at times, and he would show his presence in the cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. It said he moved from before them to behind them and was darkness to the Egyptians and light unto the Israelites. And Moses raised his hands and the water separated and the Israelites passed over on dry land the following morning. And it says the destroyer looked through the cloud back at the Egyptians as they attempted to follow, and he discomforted them, or he troubled them. And that brings us to this morning's lesson, as we know what happened. We'll talk a little bit about that in the Song of Moses in the 15th chapter. We're going to spend just a little bit of time with that. The Egyptians followed them, and it says that the Israelites saw the dead wash up on the shore. And it said earlier in the chapter 14 that he would see them no more, and I take from that, they'll trouble you no more. They're not going to be with you. You're not going to have to face them. They saw corpses. They saw dead people, and they floated on the shore behind them. Before we leave this part of our story, I don't know, as I tried to get the continuity of the story last week, I don't know how much I opened it up for questions or comments. Anything about the actual departure, the Passover, the crossing of the Red Sea, before we get into the Song of Moses? Anything? Speak now. Hold your peace. Chapter 15. There we go.
Yeah. where that would have put them. I know it really doesn't matter, but it's an interesting thought.
Based on what they saw, it may have been like me out in the woods in the dark. Spend 3 days and end up where you started from, just wandering around. But certainly that was things would have been different. We talked a little bit about the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, the choices that people have, and there were choices that were made. And who knows what might have been different had Pharaoh allowed this, or whether God would have allowed it if that simple request had been granted. But interesting, and I make this point over and over because I see myself in it, that at the call of Moses, the call of Aaron, the call of Pharaoh, there was a call to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh answered the call by saying no. That in that same sense, all of us are called. We're called, and we may be Moses, or we may be Pharaoh. We may be being called right now through the Scripture and through our knowledge of what we need to be doing in our households and in our businesses and in our life and our family life, and we may just choose to say, I don't feel like it. No, I'm not going to let my people go. I'm not going to lead my family the way I should lead my family. We have callings, and we answer them. And we saw Pharaoh's answer, and we'll see a little bit the consequences of that answer this morning in the midst of the Red Sea. Revelation chapter 15, verse 3, make a note of it, turn to it if you want, but what was that song, Larry? I never did. When my microphone kept falling off, I never did take the time. I called Larry last night to try to figure out where the words to the song of Moses and the Lamb. Y'all remember that? And I was racking myself and didn't have a songbook at the house, but did you see where it was, Larry? In the chorus. We will rest in the fair and happy land by and by, just across on the evergreen shore, and we will sing the song of Moses and the Lamb by and by, and dwell with Jesus evermore. In Revelation chapter 15, verse 3, that term is used, that we will sing, or that the seven angels, the 12 elders, would sing the song of Moses and the Lamb. And this song, that many times when we study Exodus in my history, is I read it and I say, yeah, that's the song of Moses, okay. What you got? 682, what song is that? You want to sing it for us? What's that? The New Song. I think I was thinking of that one too. But that term is used several times in our, that term is used several times in our singing. And we study Exodus, and we get to Exodus chapter 15, and we read the song of Moses, and what am I going to do with that? As a teacher, I mean, we're going to read that, and it really doesn't have the impact on us when we read this. In many ways, it recounts the stories that we've already studied, but as I thought about that, wonder how they sang that song. Wonder where they sang that song. Was it around the campfire after they came out of the dry seabed, which is now water again at the Red Sea, and they sit around their campfires and somebody begins and they all sing? Do they sing this song as the massive throng of people come out of the riverbed and they sing this song and looking back at the dead Pharaoh's army behind them? This was a wonderful song. And I dare say it was sang on and off for 40 years. And 40 years later, they would have sang that song and say, you know, that's an old one. You remember when we used to sing that song? Verses 1 through 3 are verses that deal with the praises of a victorious God. They talk about the power of God and His victory, and He is a God of war, and they were amongst men of war. Moses had been a man of war. Pharaoh had led armies. But this God of war won every battle he fought. And he only fought righteous battles and defeated evil people. And that's what it refers to in this song in verses 1 through 3. In verses 4 through 12, it deals with the praises over the deeds of the Egyptians. It just recounts that story. And if we read it, that's what we studied last week. And it wouldn't have the impact on us as it probably did those children around the campfire, or as they toted their goods and sang of this glorious place they were going to and who was leading them and how they got there. This song was, it meant something to them. Did you ever think about in verse 9, chapter 15, "And the enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My lust shall be satisfied on them, and I will draw my sword, and my hand shall destroy them." That was Pharaoh. And as they raced across Goshen with all of the chariots of the land of Egypt, and they get to this cloud, and their horses are wheeling, if you see it in the terms of the Ten Commandments and Charlton Heston, trying to get there. And when they finally get through, and the destroyer lets them through, and the walls of the water are piled up vertically upright, it says in verse 8. "The floods stop upright as a heap, and the depths are congealed in the heart of the sea." Congealed means to harden like ice. That it was just a wall there. And as he gets that and he goes, go. Wonder, was this arrogance? Was it stupidity? Was it anger? What? You know, the same power that separated those walls, did he stop to think that the same power that separated them and held them up was the same power that would release them, or could release them? Or what was he thinking before he put his first soldier's chariot into that riverbed? Knowing his own land, knowing that this was a riverbed, seeing those walls. After everything he had seen, and yet we do the same thing, don't we? In the decisions that we make in life, and I will do this, and I'm going to do that, and this is what I plan to do. And the truth is God will let us if He so wishes. I mean, we get all consumed in what we're capable of, and what we're doing, and what we're going to do. And it's not that much different than Pharaoh. He was the most powerful king in the world, and he was going to get these slaves in spite of whatever this was he saw. I don't know. It just puzzles me to see everything that he saw, and the arrogance to continue on. It says that the Lord blasted that water open with a blast of air from his nostrils, and that's an image, a figure. I don't know if we got a huge nose up there blowing air. It is the personage of God and the power that just from His breath, the power that manifested from His breath, that the seas were open to allow 2 million people to cross. This wasn't a gap that everybody stood side by side. It opened the sea up. Images that we don't need to lose and skip over this song that they sang. It says that once the waters resumed their place, and again, I should have made a note of the actual verses, but said that they sunk like lead. Can you imagine the chain, the mail, the armor, the everything, and they just sunk like lead, the song says. Don't you know the joy that came from the Israelites to sing that song, to talk about their torturer, their taskmaster, their bearer of the whip, and their God made them sink like lead. Vivid images that they would have sang and they would have taught and that would be reminded for their children for years and years to come. That was verses 4 through 12, and verses 13 through 19 speaks of the promises that will be done in the land. There's almost a theme that goes through the song from verse 1 to verse 2. To verse 3. And verse 3 and the closing verses, the passages of that song are the deeds that are going to happen, and the fear and dread that would be impressed upon the hearts of the people. Do you think there were spies in the land of Egypt? I was thinking, how would Edom know? You know, I mean, how would they? And I know the story would go in the caravan. Maybe it was caravans that came through the road of Shur or the Canaanite highway. The word got to these people and they trembled. What passage in Joshua tells us of the truth of this some many, many years later? Anybody remember what I'm looking for? Rahab, they knew, didn't they? They had heard the story in Jericho, and here we have 40 years earlier saying that they'll know, they know you're coming. The word's already going there. And they're singing about it in verses 13 through 19. Sinking like lead in verse 10. We get down to the end of chapter 15, and it says that Miriam, the prophetess, and I should have said in verse 1 that it seems as if Moses was the song leader. Did you notice that? That Moses and all the people sang this song. That this was the song of Moses, certainly wrote it by inspiration because it's in the Bible, but this is Moses' song and all the people sang. And in the closing verses in 20 and 21, it says that Miriam went before the women and played the tambourine and danced and repeated maybe a counter harmony. You know, I mean, I like that. When our ladies do that and you hear almost the voice of angels singing in the background, I don't know what this sounded like, but I think it must have been something. And that's what Miriam and the ladies did in verses 20 and 21. Before we move on to verse 22 and Mara and the wilderness of Shur, anybody got any comments about the Song of Moses? So, they leave the dry riverbed. They've left their enemies dead on the seashore behind them, and it says that they have traveled 3 days' journey into the wilderness of Shur, and they come to a place and they finally find water. And what was the condition of this water? It was bitter. Now, why would God have done that? Well, why? I mean, here they're singing this song, praising Him. They're on the way to the promised land, flowing with milk and honey, and they come to the only water they got, and it's bitter. Why would God have done that? It could have been sweet. It could have been chocolate milk. God can do anything. Anybody got an idea of why God would do this? It was a decision, though, wasn't it? He was testing. It was a decision. They come to water, and here the Israelites are out in this desert. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in here in just a minute. But they come to this desert, and the camels start running. They're getting to the water, and it's bitter. The first big body of water they've come to, and it's bitter. And the people complain. God's testing them. And we talked a little bit last week, and I don't know how much agreement there was with you, but I think myself that a lot of the plagues weren't seen by the Israelites, and 2 million people in the land of Goshen removed from the place where Pharaoh's palace was, that there were many things that they hadn't seen. They were just now seeing the powers, the cloud, the pillar of fire, the destroyer, the death. These were still things that had happened. How long are we talking about now? We don't know how long the plagues lasted. Maybe as much as a year. But how long are we in, how long have they picked up their victuals and left? Months? How long has the trial begun, the journey begun? Well, they started on the first month, the month of the pre-exilic date. The month was Nisan. I was looking up the dates and seeing what the names of these months were. Was Nisan, but that was the post-exilic captivity. Is that better? Post-captivity name for the month. The month of Abib, on the 15th day, and they observed it for 7 days through the 21st. Now, I don't know if they were through the Passover now. We talked about them observing the Passover as they left, 7 days. We just know that when they got to the Red Sea and then they passed through, that here are 3 more days. And then they're going to encamp here in just a minute in Elam. And they're going to camp there for some period of time before they come to Rephidim. And that's going to be 1 month. So somewhere in the neighborhood, or the 15th day of the second month, we're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of a month now. This wandering through Goshen, this observing of the Lord's of the Passover, of coming to the Red Sea, all of these things happened in a matter of days. They come to this bitter water and they begin to complain. How does He remedy this situation? James, what does He do with this bitter water? Jeremy, what does He do with the bitter water? threw a tree in it. That's what I would have done. He tells Moses to take a tree and throw it in, and the waters became sweet. Follows that by saying, I will, if you will diligently hearken, this is in verse 26, to the voice of the Lord, and do that which is right, I'm not going to plague you with the things that you have seen demonstrated over the last months. You're not going to suffer the things that the Egyptians had suffered, but this is a test, the first one in the wilderness to come to, and he sweetens the water and he says, if you'll just obey, all you got to do is ask. The water you thought was sweet, and it wasn't, it was bitter, but when you asked, I replied and I made it sweet for you. This was a test. This was by design on God's part to let this nation that just maybe already in their own minds defeated the most powerful nation in the world and got their heads puffed up a little bit and we're on our way to a land that flows with milk and honey and everything is going our way except for this bitter water. We can't make it this way. And they asked, and God replied. This seems like a fairly simple test, one that was quickly remedied. Wasn't a big deal, but we're going to see quickly that they failed the test. They got okay. All right, I'm okay today, Lord. I mean, this water's okay. This is good bottled water. Carson and I were working yesterday, and we drank some unfiltered water right out of the tap. I didn't know what bottled water was when I was mowing grass, and I was couldn't drink that water because it wasn't bottled water. Right? We'll drink this water, Lord. It's okay. If you'll just obey me. He didn't say that, did he? We're going to see a lot of complaining. In verse 27, and they came to Elim, where were 12 wells of water and 70 palms, 70 palm trees, and they encamped there by the water. And to my point earlier, I don't know how many days, but we've got a matter of around 27 days that between the 3 days that they traveled from the Red Sea to Shur. This is the first time that evidently the cloud stops and they make an encampment and they stay there for some period of time. And the word Elim means big tree. So these palm trees would have been an oasis with 12 wells of water and these people and their herds would have gathered around and this would have been the first place they stayed just for less than a month as they travel and they walk and they sing and the clank of the bells around the neck of the lead goat and each little herd and all of these noises and the children playing and all of these things they camp at Elim. In chapter 16, and they took their journey from Elim and all the congregation of the children of Israel came into the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month after departing out of the land of Egypt. Again, we don't know exactly where this is, but it's somewhere getting closer down here into the bottom of the triangle. It's interesting that I looked at the dimensions. It's 180 miles on the west side. It's 130 miles on the east side. It's 150 miles across this peninsula. And we picture, we picture just sand. Not even any cactuses. You know, that's my Sinai anyway, my wilderness. I'm not sure we've got a good image of exactly what that was like. It wasn't sand. How do we figure, anybody tell me how we know it wasn't just an old desert sand? It was wilderness. It was uninhabited. More than sand, though, wasn't it? Why? A lot of rocks. Cliffs. Well, those goats and sheep and cows weren't eating dirt, though, were they? They had huge flocks with them, remember? I mean, we're going to see in a minute that they asked for food. And where was the manna deposited? With the dew of the morning, wasn't it? I don't know. It was different, I think, than I have in my mind's eye of what this was like. They get in verse 2, they get out into the wilderness of Sin, and the whole children of Israel murmured against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. And they begin immediately again to say, We could have just died in Egypt. We had our flesh pots there. We had our lentils. We had our cucumbers. We had food. We had a place to stay. We had cool breezes coming off of the River Nile and the Mediterranean Sea. I mean, we were in the best of the best in the land of Egypt, and you brought us out here, and we got nothing to eat. Did they have anything to eat? What do they travel with that provided meat? They had goats and sheep and cows, didn't they? You know, it's like me and the girls going down and saying, there ain't nothing to eat around here. Well, it's not the restaurant they want to eat at, or it's not what they want in the refrigerator, but we got something to eat. We're far away from starving, and I never thought about it. These people are traveling with the livestock, the meat packing company. Now, they couldn't consume it. They couldn't eat all of it, but they weren't starving. Have you thought about that? Then said the Lord in verse 4, behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people will go out and gather a certain rate every day that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no. And it shall come to pass on the sixth day, they shall prepare that which they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily. And Moses and Aaron said unto all the children of Israel, at even, then ye shall know that the Lord hath brought you out of the land of Egypt, and in the morning ye shall see the glory of the Lord, for he hath heard your murmurings against the Lord. And what are we that you should murmur against us? Every time you've called, he's answered. Every time you've needed something, he's responded. You're out here murmuring because you don't have Wendy's, all you got is McDonald's, and you had a guy beating you with a whip just a month ago. You were in bondage. You were slaves. You were as chattel. You were worthless. And you're your own people, your own nation, free to do what you want. I can't remember the passage I read, but there was a passage here as far as observance of the Passover, and it gives the allowance for if somebody wasn't there on the 14th day of the first month, if they weren't there, what provision did God make for them to take the Passover? You remember? They could take it a month later, couldn't they? And in one of the passages in Numbers, I believe it said, if someone is on a long journey, now this is in the wilderness when this is talking about, if somebody's on a long journey, if they're gone and they come back, and they miss the 14th day of the first month, then they can take it the next month. I'm telling you that there was throngs of people and there was movement and people were coming and going. We're going to see the Amalekites that they would come in and they would fight against them and they would fight out there somewhere. Maybe miles away from where Moses was. In Deuteronomy chapter 25 it says that they fought on the edges against the weak and the infirmed. The Amalekites would come in and they would do these little spot battles and they would kill some people. Or maybe they'd just take their flocks. But they were pestering the Israelites. This was a massive group of people and they could do what they wanted to do. They were free. They didn't have somebody beating them. And yet they murmur. You see who it says that they were murmuring against in that verse? And who are... And you're murmuring against us? Who were they murmuring against? They were murmuring against God. That's who they were murmuring. And I'm just the leader. I just got the rod here. I'm just the one that he talks to. You're not murmuring against me and Aaron. You're murmuring against God. But in the morning, you're going to see the glory of the Lord. And I like this term. I've used it in a sermon or two and in Jewish law and in their history, they have the glory of the Lord in the Hebrew language is Shekinah. And we see Shekinah, this term, the one that has the most vivid image for me is on the mercy seat, on the Ark of the Covenant, where the two large angels have their wings spread and they look to the center of the mercy seat and he says, what does God say? I will meet you there. That's where the glory of the Lord was. The Hebrew people call that Shekinah. And it was that bright, shining light. And here in chapter 16, God tells them, Moses tells them, that in the morning, you're going to see the glory of the Lord in the cloud out over the wilderness. In this in this forsaken land, this place that now you don't seem to want to be. You want to go back that direction. That even in this place, God is with you. Can you think of the passages where it says, and the glory of the Lord appeared to them? I can think of just bunches of them. Can you remember when Moses went up on the mountain? We'll talk about that in a week or two. And he came down and his face was so bright that they couldn't look upon him, that he had to put a veil on, that it was the glory of the Lord. And in the morning, you're going to see it. Hear their murmuring. And again, the Lord answers their murmurings. And in verse 9, and Moses spake unto Aaron, say unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, come near before the Lord, for He's heard your murmurings. And it came to pass, as Aaron spoke unto the whole congregation of the children of Israel, that they looked toward the wilderness, and behold, Shekinah appeared in the cloud. God was there. And the Lord spake unto Moses, and we're going to have the introduction of manna and the quail. And I've heard the murmurings of Israel in verse 12, speaking to them, saying, at even you shall eat flesh, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. And it came to pass at even that the quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay around about the host. And it was as coriander seed. You know what coriander seed looks like? It's a Cheerio. I don't know. That's what I got. Coriander seed is a white, small seed about the size of a pearl. And they were together an omer for each individual. Those are frosted flakes, but, you know, they're, you know, just little. They could boil them, they could bake them, they would grind them, they could make cakes out of them. They had all kinds of different ways that they prepared, and that's 7 pints. A little less than just over a half gallon, and for every individual they were to gather this every morning until the 6th day, and they were to gather twice as much for every individual. And it says that as they gathered this, that they would gather, and that as the day went on, before the next day and the next gathering, no matter how much they took, it was a general amount, an omer, and Carson didn't eat as much today. Or Carson ain't a whole lot today, that they never lacked for anything, and they never had anything left over. They had exactly what they needed, as long as they did what God said. And I'll tell you that's the way it is for us. We've got enough. We don't need too much. And we need to use what we've got. And that's what the Lord did for them. I always thought about the quail. I thought they had quail every night. How often did they get the quail? We only got 2 instances where they got the quail. I thought they had quail. We can explain these events. There's been historians and biologists and everybody trying to figure out how this quail thing happened and how the manna happened. But there's really no reason to explain it because it's a miraculous story anyway. There is a true story even up and I don't know if it still happens, but up until modern days, that the quail would fly across the Red Sea, and I quail hunt, and they're little birds, and they're not migratory birds. They don't travel long distances. In fact, when I hunt them, they're lucky if you travel they'll travel to the end of the building. They don't fly very far, the quail that I'm familiar with. But the truth of the stories are, up until 100 years ago, is they would fly, and they wouldn't beat their wings the whole time, but they would carry in the wind. And they would sail. The wind would bring them once a year, and they tuckered out, would fall on the ground. And Egyptians, even Egyptians, Arabs, somebody would pick these up off the ground. They could run, but they were beat, tired, and they would literally, up until modern times, you could go and gather quail off the ground. Now I don't know whether that's what happened, but it was certainly miraculous. So even if God says this evening this is going to happen, that was a miracle in and of itself. That far out over the Red Sea and the quail are coming, that they're going to land in our camp from a mile surrounding us in every direction and piled up on the ground, that we're going to have quail. It was miraculous, if nothing else, that it happened when He said it would happen. But these events and this food and what manna is, did you notice what manna meant? What is it? What is it? I mean, the King James Version says, it is what? It reverses the word, something like that. I don't know if I've got the words back, but the actual meaning of the word was manhu, which is, what is this? The first time they saw it, they didn't know what it was. And Moses explained to them as God had explained to him, and they gathered it, and each one gathered an omer, and they would pick it up in the morning. Did you notice what would happen when the sun baked hot? What happened to the manna? Melted. I don't know if by inspirations that is put in there for a reason, but one observation is, if you didn't get it, it was gone. We're going to see people that are maybe not gathering. We're going to see people that are gathering way too much, and they're hoarding just how much they can pick. And they were told exactly how much to pick and how often to pick it and what they were supposed to do with it. And it says in verse 19, and Moses said, "Let no man leave of it till the morning. Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto Moses, but some of them left it until the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was wroth with them." Just little instruction. Just don't eat of that tree. Eat anything else, but don't eat of that tree. Eat of that tree. Just don't keep it. And they kept it. And it bred worms. Verse 21, "And they gathered it every morning, every man according to his eating. And when the sun waxed hot, it melted." It was almost like God provided this for them. Go out there and get it. I'm not going to leave it out there all day. Get out of your bed. Go out there and get your meal. Slothfulness. Just go to work. I provided it for you, but go get it. I ain't going to leave it out there for you all day. In verse 27, "And it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day to forgather, and they found none." Imagine that. On the seventh day, "and the Lord said unto Moses, how long will y'all refuse to keep my commandments?" Again, provided for them. Now, what in the world were they doing out there on Sabbath morning? Can you think of why they would? I thought of two reasons. Either they were too lazy to go pick the day before, or they just said, "I'm going to go get me some more." Either they were lazy the day before, or they were too greedy and gathering the excess, but either way, they violated what God said. I don't know why they went out there on Sabbath morning, but it was direct contradiction to what God said, and they did it anyway. I don't understand these things and what these people did, but we always need to remember that we do the same thing. God gives direct instructions, and we do otherwise all the time. Anybody else in their version in verse 3 of chapter 16, anybody else have anything other than flesh pots? Meat pots? I had one reading called it fish, baskets of fish. They were on the Nile. Well, I jumped around a little bit. We got the manna and we got the quail. We'll pick up there Wednesday. Did you get someone else to teach Scott? You got that arranged? I've got to be in Grand Rapids and Scott's got to be somewhere. So we're going to pick up maybe in verse 32. Whoever's teaching that, as far as they're going to keep this manna for an institution for generations to come, and they put it in the testimony. They didn't have the testimony yet, did they? This was Moses writing back. What you got? Oh, you're the one teaching. Okay, so we're going to finish up in the very closing verses of chapter 16 and go to the water that's striking the rock. I really wanted to do striking the rock and the Amalekites, but we'll let Rob deal with that. And thank you for your attention this morning and your comments.